From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we mark the Veterans Day holiday with a talk by the late eminent historian Howard Zinn. He delivered this talk in May of 2006 in Los Angeles, and it's entitled Just War.
I mean, we are now struggling, we in this country, to stop the war in Iraq. We're working very hard on that, and we're going to succeed. The war in Iraq is going to have to come to an end. But what happens then? What happens after the war in Iraq? Our country has been fighting war after war after war, ever since the end of World War II, ever since that war which was supposed to bring an end to war. And after Vietnam, we thought, no more wars. And then the government decided also, the people of the United States apparently have turned against war. This is bad. They described what they called the Vietnam syndrome. Syndrome is a word for a sickness. The sickness was that the American people had turned against the government, against the FBI, against Congress, against the establishment, against the war. This was the Vietnam syndrome, and the United States government set out to somehow do away with that syndrome by fighting small, quick, victorious wars against weak opponents to get the American population accustomed to war, once again. And this is what they've been trying to do. The Iraq War represents the latest of it, except that it hasn't been quick. It's been going on for 3 years. And it may be that the Vietnam syndrome has not been eliminated, that the American people are beginning to understand the futility of war, the immorality of war. We're seeing a growth in consciousness among the American people, and that's a very positive, encouraging thing to see. But what comes next? They're already beating the drums for war in Iran, right? Already talking about bombing Iran, already drawing up the plans. And when they're confronted with this, they said, we're only drawing up plans. They're creating a hysteria about Iran the way they created a hysteria about Iraq. I don't think they will succeed this time. I think the American people have learned something about the war in Iraq, which makes them more suspicious of what the government is saying about Iran. But I think we have to think about not this war, not the next war. We don't want to have to create another anti-war movement, and another anti-war movement, and another anti-war movement. We really have to present in the world the idea, an idea which is sort of obviously utopian and long-term, but an idea which absolutely must take hold. Its time has come. The idea that war must be abolished. Gino Strada showed you, told you about Einstein's quote. When Einstein said that in 1932, he was attending a conference in Geneva, which was called the Disarmament Conference. Anytime you see the words disarmament conference, be suspicious. When the governments of the world use the word disarmament, they don't mean it. And so Einstein attended this disarmament conference. He, like so many people, was disillusioned by the horror of World War I. And what did he hear at this disarmament conference? He heard these nations talking about, these weapons will be banned, and these weapons will be okay. And he did something which nobody expected Einstein to do. He called a press conference. Einstein doesn't do things like that. But he did, and he said, and you saw those words on the screen, war cannot be humanized, war can only be abolished. And that's the theme of this campaign that we want to initiate. And you're part of the initiation. We expect you to spread the word. You expect you to not just to stop the war in Iraq, but we expect you to begin talking to everybody you can about the abolition of war itself. Governments are not going to do it. Governments can never be depended to advance the cause of peace or justice or human rights. I mean, in the course of human history, governments have never been dependable in taking care of the needs of people. And after all, governments are not set up for that purpose. Governments are set up to serve certain interests, and those are not the interests of the people. This is a very important thing for people to grasp, people who have some naive conception that we very often grow up with in this country, that the government is our friend, and no, the government is not our friend. Occasionally, occasionally it can get friendly. When there's a great people's movement that compels it to be friendly, and then, so it is really up to us, it is up to the people of the world to abolish war, because governments won't do it. And very often you hear it's said that, well, people are not going to do it because war is part of human nature. How many times have you heard that? How many times have you heard, I think I once figured it out, anytime you get into a discussion of war, like 12 minutes into the conversation, somebody says, oh, it's human nature. Test that out. It's a scientific observation of mine. 12 minutes, yeah. If war were a part of human nature, governments would not have to go to such enormous lengths to persuade people to go to war. People would rush spontaneously. No, governments have to work at it. They have to work very hard at it. The natural instincts of people are not for war. The natural instincts of people are for compassion and comradeship and brotherhood and sisterhood. Those are the natural instincts of people, but governments work very hard. They work by seduction, they work by propaganda, and they work by coercion to get people to go to war. At the end of World War II, when the Nazi leaders were being tried in Nuremberg, and they were in their prison cells awaiting trial, and a psychologist was given the job of interviewing these Nazi leaders in their prison cells, talking to them. And one of them wrote a book. He kept a diary, he kept notes. And he records in his book a conversation he had with Hermann Göring, second in command to Hitler, head of the Luftwaffe. And he asked, well, how come the German people went along with Hitler? And Göring said, well, of course, people don't want war. Some poor slob, this was Göring's word, I don't know what the word is in German, but this is how they interpreted it, translated it. Some poor slob working on a farm, he doesn't want to go to war, but he can be convinced. He can be propagandized. He can be told there's an enemy out there that must be defeated. He can be told that this is done for the country, this is done for the people, and then you can mobilize a population for war. And this is true, Göring said, in any country. That last part of it was interesting to me. It's not just totalitarian governments, it's not just tyrannical governments that propagandize their people for war, it's so-called democratic liberal governments. And of course that has happened in this country again and again and again, where people have been deceived, people have been lied to. And we're now aware of all the lies and deceptions that have been told in connection with this war in Iraq. But the history of government lies and deception in order to get the people of the country to go to war, that goes way back. How else can governments get people to go to war? It goes back to the Mexican War. It goes back to the war in Cuba. It goes back to the Philippines. It goes back through all the wars that we've fought, deception, lies, that's how they do it. So our job is to reach back to the essential feelings of people and to break through these fogs of propaganda and cries for war, these false slogans that are raised that talk about we're going to war for democracy, we're going to war for freedom. We now have a history which shows that all these so-called wars for freedom and democracy have not brought freedom and democracy to any of the people that we've waged war against. And they certainly haven't brought freedom and democracy to this country. And you will hear them say, Memorial Day is coming up, come to think of it. Memorial Day is coming up at the end of this month, and you'll have a lot of flag waving and a lot of trumpets blowing and a lot of speeches made honoring the dead of wars. And of course, yes, the people who died in wars should be honored, but war should not be honored. And the makers of war should not be honored, you see. And you will hear the speech makers say they gave their lives for their country. How many times have you heard that? They gave their lives for their country. There's a double lie in that. One, they did not give their lives. Their lives were taken away from them, you see. You know. And second, they didn't die for their country. They died for their government. The country did not profit from their deaths. There were people, there were interests that profited from their deaths. In the present case, the young people who were dying in Iraq, thank you. The young people who are dying in Iraq, that's Marco, who's keeping me alive. Regular doses of water and who knows what else. You see. But the young people who are dying in Iraq are not dying for the country. It's a terrible thing to say. The country is not benefiting from their debts. They're dying for Bush and Cheney. They're dying for Halliburton and the corporations that make money out of war. You know, wise men throughout history have recognized this. Plutarch recognized this. The poor go to war for the benefit of the rich. Eugene Debs recognized this. He was sent to prison for 10 years in World War I for saying, the poor, the working class, who fight the wars, and it's the rich who send them to war. I went through a certain trajectory myself about war, because there was a time when I believed in the concept of just war. That is, I believed that there were just wars and unjust wars. Good wars and bad wars. And I think that's a very, very common belief among people, you know. Buffalo, I once had a student who wrote a paper about war, and in her paper she said, you know, wars are like wines. There are good years and bad years. There are good wars and bad wars. But she said, war is not like wine. War is like cyanide. One drop and you're dead. I always remembered what she said, because it fitted my own experience, the development of my own thought, because I volunteered for the Second World War. I had to tell you what war it was so that you wouldn't think it was the Spanish-American War. But I volunteered for that war and became a bombardier in the Air Force, and because I believe this was a good, yes, it was right. It was a good war. Studs Terkel has done a world history of people who lived through World War II, and he calls it the good war. Although if you look closely, you'll see he put quotation marks. And I realized that I did not know when I dropped my bombs what I was doing to human beings. You drop bombs from 30,000 feet high, 6 miles high, you don't see any people. You don't hear screams, you don't see blood. You don't know what you're doing. I mean, this is so much the nature of modern warfare. You know, people blithely send off rockets and cruise missiles and drop bombs, and they really don't know what they are doing. And they come back and you see them on television exultant. We just completed our mission. I remember those pictures at the end of during the first Gulf War, the pilots would come back for their missions. We hit our targets. The truth is they did not know what they hit. You know? And so I began to think about that. And began to think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And think about those several hundred thousand people who died. These were not the people who bombed Pearl Harbor. These were the children of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've got to think about the 100,000 people in Tokyo who died in one night of firebombing in Tokyo in the spring of 1945. Yeah. One night of firebombing. And we had denounced the fascists for bombing civilian populations. We had denounced them for their cruelty, their brutality, and here we were. I know. And the bombing of Dresden, and the bombing of, 30,000, 40,000, 60,000 people, Frankfurt, Hamburg, altogether perhaps 600,000 civilians in Germany died in the bombing. An equal number died, 600,000 or so, in Japan. I began to think about the good war and the just war, and realized that war poisons everybody who engages in it. You start off, I recreated this, my own psychology, that is starting off deciding these are the bad guys, we are the good guys. And then realizing that once I had made that initial decision that they are the bad guys and we are the good guys, once I made that initial decision, I didn't have to think anymore. I didn't have to question anything anymore. From that point on, anything goes. That's just the psychology of the just war, you know? And so then Hiroshima and Nagasaki and then Tokyo, then anything can happen. And what I didn't realize was that what war does is it turns everybody into bad guys, both sides, whatever the initiating situation was. And you can look back through history and you see this happening again. You go back to the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians were the good guys and the Spartans were the bad guys. And then in the course of the war, the Athenians begin to behave just like the Spartans. So yeah, I began to think about, here I was testing war by its best example World War II, this example that everybody points to and they say, well, you know, there's such a thing as a good war, and World War II is an example. So I wanted to take the most extreme test of the idea of a good war, which is World War II, and when I looked at it, I came away with a much more complex view of this good war than I had at the beginning. And I realized that what happens in war, even a war against a tyrant, and war is always against a tyrant. There's always a tyrant to make war on. When you make war against a tyrant, the people you kill are the victims of the tyrant. This is what we've been doing all along. People we've been killing in Iraq and saying, oh, we, you know, Saddam Hussein, we've got to get rid of Saddam Hussein. People we kill in Iraq are the victims of Saddam Hussein. So then I looked at the world after the war, as the years went by. And I had at the end of the war, I had gotten a letter from General Marshall, who was the general of generals in World War II. And I think it was the first five-star general. It was, you might say, a personal letter addressed to me and 16 million others who had served in the military. And the letter says something like, congratulations, we've won the war against the terrible foe, and it will be a new world. Well, looking around, and you saw in Gito's chart about the wars that have followed World War II, looking around the world after the war, we had defeated fascism, Mussolini, Hitler, the Japanese military machine. We had not defeated fascism around the world. There was still fascism in the world. There's still racism in the world. There's still militarism in the world. And there's still war, war after war. After war. So I came to the conclusion that war is a quick fix, as violence is always a quick fix. When you can't really solve a problem intelligently, you turn to violence. You know, and violence seems to solve something. Well, it's like a drug. And war is a drug. You know, you win and you have a high. Don't ask me how I know this. You win the war, and there's a moment of exaltation. And I remember when the war ended in Europe, and I was there in England, and the lights went on all over England, and we poured into the streets for the first time with the lights on in the city of Norwich, England, and they were passing out fish and chips to everybody free. It's great, all that exaltation. And then the reality sets in. And the reality after World War II was 50 million people had died, and we were still going through war after war. And so, yes, we have to decide once and for all, no matter how long it takes. And after all, the movement against slavery was a utopian movement in the 1830s. I mean, how are you going to abolish slavery? They're holding 4 million black people in slavery, and it's very useful to them. We're not going to be able to do this. But a movement grew. Slavery was not abolished just by the Emancipation Proclamation. A movement, an anti-slavery movement, grew. It seemed utopian at the beginning, but it grew and grew and grew, and finally reached a point where Lincoln and Congress had to react to it, and slavery was abolished. It's possible. It's possible to end war. It's, you know, you can go through an experience, a bad experience, bad experience, bad experience, and you begin to think, we can't stop this. We can only have bad experiences. And then a certain point is reached where something snaps and you say, I'm not going to do this anymore. We have to do that with war. And it's... And we have to think about this. They cannot carry out wars without us. This is a very important thing. It's just like the workers in General Motors in the 1930s, when they faced the enormously powerful corporation, General Motors, and they were working under conditions which they didn't like, for wages which were too low and hours which were too long. He said, we're not going to be able to defeat General Motors, you see. And then they realized General Motors needs us. All we have to do is stop working, and General Motors is helpless. That's true of governments. And when people decide that they are not going to support the government, when GIs decide that they are not going to continue fighting, when they come back from the war and they organize against the war, when the government simply cannot find enough people to carry on the war, then a war must come to an end. This is what happened in the Vietnam War. What happened in the Vietnam War is, and you, many of you remember this, you know, that more and more and more people in the United States turned away from the government, and the government did not have legitimacy anymore. And it could not carry on the war when ROTC chapters closed, and when hundreds of thousands of young people refused to go to war, and when the GIs came back, and the GIs in the field were refusing to go out on patrol, and B-52 pilots were refusing to fly B-52s over Hanoi and Haiphong anymore. And then and the Vietnam veterans came back and they formed Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and they threw their medals over a fence in Washington, D.C. And at a certain point, the government decided, no, it will not be able to carry on the war. This is beginning to happen in the war in Iraq. And so the war at some point will come to an end. And it is up to us to decide that we are not going to support any war, whatever reason is given to us by whatever liars sit in the White House. We're not going to do that. Because if nothing else, aside from the horrors of war, for one very important reason, war and the expenditure of all of our energy and talent and national wealth for war is preventing us from solving the problems that we have in the world, the really serious problems that we have in the world, the sickness and homelessness and the lack of water in the world and what's happening to the environment and how do we deal with natural disasters like Katrina and what happened in Asia when the earthquakes come. These are things that are affecting huge, huge numbers of people, billions of people, and we're not able to deal with that because the governments are fixed on war. So that's one very, very important reason for abolishing war, because it is possible to imagine a world without war. It's possible to imagine a world in which this very talented human race, we are very talented, you know how talented, amazing things are done by human beings. We turn our talents to creating a world where everybody has health care and everybody is housed and the air is cleaned up and the waters are cleaned up. It's possible to do that, you see. And so we will start modestly here in this church. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.